just say two words to introduce the two commentators, Italian commentators of this session. This is quite a special session in a conference, since we will have the opportunity to listen directly from the speakers the programs elaborated at a transnational level, and to question them directly. So it's quite a special opportunity. We have the privilege to have Professor Luciano Bardi here as a chair of the session of today and commentator. He's been professor of political science and international relations at the University of Pisa and at the University of Bologna, as well as a large number of worldwide universities, too many to be mentioned. Currently, he is professor at the European University Institute's Alcide De Gasperi Research Center. His main research interests include political parties at national and European level, party systems, elections, democracy, our main issue of yesterday, and representation in the European Parliament. So, now to chair and coordinate this session of today. The other commentator is Professor Paolo Borioni.
I'm behind the screen here.
Behind the screen.
Now
we
move over. Yeah.
Yeah, it's putting back.
Paolo Borioni is professor at the Dipartimento di Comunicazione e Ricerca Sociale at Sapienza University of Rome. He is an historian. He teaches history of political institutions. He's an expert. He's a scholar of Scandinavian countries. Belongs to the Center for Nordic Studies. He wrote quite recently, a book on Denmark, and he wrote some years ago a book on about Sweden. He takes part of the scientific committee of the Gramsci Foundation, as many of others of the present here. So I let to Professor Bardi the floor, and he will introduce the speakers of today.
Okay, I'll try not to place this too close. I tend to speak loud. I don't want too much of a feedback. European elections, which we are here to discuss today, have reached their 40th anniversary. Everybody obviously knows that, and it's one of the reasons why this year's elections are particularly important. What we tend to forget, and at least when I see the debate, I hear very distinctive voices in the debate, we tend to forget, I was saying, that 1979, the year they were first held, marked another 40th anniversary. And that was the beginning of World War II. Okay? And I think this is really something that we should pause a minute and think about. We tend to forget this. Already in 1979, World War II seemed to be so remote. Yet now some of the rhetoric that was I don't want to say that the rhetoric was responsible for the war, but that was associated with the developments that led to the war is coming back. So I think we should think about this and consider this as another element of the importance of these elections. 40 years ago, we had a relatively recent world war behind us. Now we have 40 years of what could be characterized as unfinished democracy, but nevertheless democracy in the European Union. As someone who has studied European elections for all these 40 years, sometimes I feel unhappy, you know, I feel disillusioned. The hopes in 1979 were much higher. As I mentioned before, I was lucky enough to conduct the first survey of the members of the European Parliament, And although they were already frustrated because of the lack of powers of the European Parliament, which in those days were very limited, there was a lot of enthusiasm, a lot of hope. And now, of course, we have to contend with the immediate performance of the Union, which we don't see as being particularly satisfactory. But anyway, if we go back to what Europe was like only 40 years before, then we must consider these elections as extremely important because it is the symbol of the change in the relations across the states, the member states, and in itself, this is an achievement to be treasured. I would say that, having said this, and considering the prevalent intergovernmental nature of the EU, which means, and this morning's debate, and I imagine yesterday's as well, has shown we cannot expect too much, I think that we have to consider also what is the more immediate importance of these elections. Naturally, who wins or loses? Huh? Who goes up and who goes down? More specifically, will these elections see a significant progress of new challenger parties, as my good colleague and friend Hans-Peter Kriese calls them, all lumping them all together? Populist, Eurosceptic, or simply sovereignist? Will there be such dramatic progress? And will there be a decline of the traditional core parties of the European party system? We know that within that core there will be some up and downs, but at this juncture, I think, at least from my perspective, what is more important is what the overall size of the core is going to be. And then, of course, there are other parties that I see as also, I see in a positive light. We have an exponent of the Green Party here, and to an extent also the United Left, whatever it is called now. But this is more for the speakers to discuss. I think my position is more, rather than what the fortunes of the single parties are going to be, is to indicate what the more important institutional developments may be. And what I see here is, as the most important institutionally related development that could come after this election, is what's going to happen to the decision by the parties to continue with the presentation of their leading candidates. Less than a week ago, there was one of the debates at the European University in Florence, and obviously the dynamism of this process is quite evident. So the appointment of the president of the new commission could be again strongly influenced, if not determined, by this decision that the parties have taken autonomously. There's no treaty that tells them to do that. The treaty says that the Council, European Council, had to take into account the results, but not, doesn't say that the parties have to present candidates. They've done this on their own, and obviously there is a resistance on the part of the member states to this process, and I commend the parties for having insisted. Now, briefly, since in theory I have a few more minutes, I will say something that is more linked to some of the expectations of those parties that are not represented behind this table today, and that see these elections in a different light. Well, I really don't think that what is expected to happen, or at least promised by some of these parties to their electors, is a possibility. And there are a number of reasons why it is not. I don't think that whatever the results of the elections are, well, actually, whatever is not really, I cannot say whatever, because we know more or less what they're going to be, and this is a fact. Well, despite of the results that we're going to have, I don't think that Europe will be changed dramatically by this election. Europe can exploit this election as an opportunity, but I don't think there will be dramatic changes. Why? Well, I think the first reason is the same reasons I mentioned before about the dissatisfaction of the first cohort of MEPs. The powers of the parliament are not enough. Mostly, if new parties want to change the union through the parliament, they will need to have a power the parliament doesn't have, which is legislative initiative. The initiative belongs to the commission, and the parliament can force the commission to adopt one of its proposals on two conditions, which require two separate majorities. The majority in at least one parliamentary committee of the parliament, and then a majority in plenary. Okay. Now, the challenger parties, I looked at the most recent projections, can hope to obtain something between 150 and 200 seats. Even if they should find a very unlikely agreement with the European People's Party, and I'm sorry that Kramer's not here, because we could have grilled him a little bit on that. Maybe that's why he didn't come. They would fall short of a majority. They would have a very slim majority. The European People's Party is now credited with about 170 seats. Let's say there's, everything goes the challenger party's way. Still, they wouldn't go much beyond the majority. And within the European People's Party, there are parties that would not go along with it all the time. So I don't think that this is going to happen as a result of that. And the other thing is, the big narrative is that we want what we want to do, what these parties want to the European Union is enhanced powers for the states. They want the more sovereignism. They want recognition of the individual member states' interests and identities. Well, it only takes one state to reject a treaty for it not to go through. Okay? We've had a relatively recent example in 2005, France and the Netherlands did not ratify what was called, I think, not very astutely, constitutional treaty, and it was, well, actually, technically, it was not rejected. It's still there, but anyway, it was killed. So, having said that, what could be then the objective of a reform of Europe? I frankly don't see it, how it could come as a constitutional reform. So, and again, I don't want to go into this too much. I would have liked to have answers by someone who belongs to those parties on what they really expect. They cannot expect a constitutional reform of the Union that will enhance its intergovernmental nature, or It's been this morning of the speaker who mentioned that this morning is not here anymore. It was said that President Tajani talked about Europe of Nations. It is a Europe of Nations. The intergovernmental institutional path is still stronger than the supranational one. And so, you know, I don't really see what the big constitutional change could be. Having said that, now leave the floor to the real guests of this and protagonists of this afternoon's event. And since I was not instructed differently, I will use what I believe to be the alphabetical order that we have here. So for 25 minutes, I'm giving the floor to Andrew Burgess, who's the who's political advisor for the Alliance for Liberals and Democrats for Europe. The floor is yours, Andrew. Well, while I still have the floor, I want to thank the organizers for inviting me and for putting this together. I forgot that. Thank you.
Hello, good afternoon, everybody. My name is Andrew. I work for the ALDE party, not the ALDE group. I work for the ALDE party. I will make that distinction a bit more clear in this. I'm British, as you can probably tell. When I speak in English, I tend to speak a bit quickly because it's my own language. So if there's any stage I talk too quickly, wave frantically at me, I'll slow down.
We do. Okay.
Talk a bit slower for you. So yeah, I'm going to give sort of a brief, very quick overview of the difference between the party and the group, because for ALDE this is important for us because it helps frame our manifesto. And then I will introduce the process of how we arrived at our manifesto, and then a few of the key points from it. So the ALDE party was one of the first political parties that were formed in 76, ahead of the European Parliament elections in 79. In 2012, we used to be the ELBR, we then changed our name to become ALDE, and in 2017, we were one of the first European political party. Currently, we have 68 member parties from 43 countries. So in Italy, we have Più Europa, Radicali Italiani, and Team Kullensberger in Südtirol. Currently, we have 8 European prime ministers that sit around the table at the European Council. 2 of them are caretakers, but we're currently at our highest ever level. And in the European Commission, we currently count 5 commissioners. The guy in the bottom left, some of you may recognise, he's our current party president. That's Hans van Balen. And the ALDE party is the transnational alliance. And we have parliamentary groups in the European Parliament, the ALDE group, but also in the Committee of the Regions and the Council of the Parliament, the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe. And all of these are called ALDE, and they sit under our umbrella. So this is our, from our latest family picture. So our mission is to strengthen the Liberal Democrat movement in Europe, to assist our politicians and parties across Europe, to find a common liberal vision for all of our parties, and to adopt a manifesto for the European Parliament elections. As a party, we organise the pre-summit meetings. So we bring together all of the prime ministers before the European summits so they can coordinate how they're going to vote in the council that night. We organise a congress once a year and a council twice a year. The council meetings are where we adopt policy. So we adopt policy 2 times a year. Then we provide assistance to our member parties, and increasingly we are training female candidates with a new program we've started called the Women's Academy. So I mentioned the party and who we are. So this is the ALDE group. So the members of the ALDE party who get elected to the European Parliament then sit in the ALDE group in the European Parliament The chair of the group is somebody I'm sure you all recognize, Guy Verhofstadt. Currently, the ALDE group is 68 members, but only 54 of those members are ALDE party members. So the ALDE group comprises the ALDE party, the European Democrat Party, EDP, and then some independents. And this is why I mentioned this with the use of the manifesto. The ALDE group has changed its name a fair few times over the years. It's one of the first groups that was formed in the parliament. It started off as the group of Liberals and Allies, then it became Liberal and Democrat, then the Liberal Democrat Reform Group, and then ELDR, the European Liberal Democrat Reform. Then it became ALDE when it merged with the EDP, and then the ALDE party changed its name to be synonymous. So the lesson of this is the ALDE group is always a constant, but it might have a different name or different style or bring more people in or less. We sit in the middle of the chamber, and because of our size, we often make tip the balance on legislative items. So often the Grand Coalition in the previous years, or as we will have in the next European Parliament, they will need ALDE votes in order to ensure a majority on either side. So we are guarding our kingmaker position with both hands. Okay, so I'll quickly mention our Spitzenkandidat. You previously mentioned that there is each political party puts forward a candidate or two candidates. Being liberals, we always like to do things a little bit differently. So we actually have seven. It came from the basis that we believe that there should be a direct vote for the President of the European Commission by citizens. We do not have this. Nobody can vote for ALDE party in Europe. Nobody can vote directly for our candidate. Therefore, if we don't have a direct election, then we're going to put as many candidates as possible and basically choose your pick. Take one of them. This is our current team. So in our statutes, important thing to note is that our Spitzenkandidat is determined after we have adopted our manifesto. They have to apply to run on the manifesto, which is put together by the member parties, and not the other way around. So our manifesto came first, and then our team came second. After we adopted our manifesto, our member parties, they changed our procedure a little bit, and they instructed the president of our party to put together a team. They told the president to make it gender balanced, to make it relevant all across Europe, so each part of Europe is represented. The ages should be respected, and basically a very balanced team. And on all of the counts, he passed, except the gender balance, because he got 5 women and 2 males, which is not a problem. We'll settle for that. Some of the 7 you probably recognise, Emma Bonino from Italy, is on there. Guy Verhofstadt is a member of our team. The European Commissioner Violeta Bulc from Slovenia is a member of our team. And probably the most high profile of all of them is Margrethe Vestager, our Commissioner for Competition. So these are our 7 candidates, and those 7 are travelling around Europe, making a lot of work for us and the ALDE party to ensure that they help our member parties do better in their own elections. So that's why I mentioned our Spitzenkandidat, and now I come on to our manifesto, because this had to come first. So we started our process in December 2017. The difference from our party to, I imagine, the others is our policy making comes from our members up. We don't make policy unless our members want it. So my role in the Secretariat is to ensure that this process carries on smoothly. So sadly, I can't make our policy for the party, but I can make sure it's discussed in order. And going on. So in December 17, our Congress took the decision they wanted a committee to take control of drafting this manifesto. And they then instructed us to put together a team. Oops, that's not We put together a team of 12 liberals, senior mixed from all across Europe, again respecting the age, geographical balance, political profile, gender balance. You know, it was a very balanced team. We had the chair was a former prime minister, Taavi Rõivas, who was the prime minister of Estonia. We also had Nick Clegg, who was the deputy prime minister of the United Kingdom. We had, on behalf of the ALDE group, Sophie Intervelt, who's one of our vice presidents. We had the president of our youth organisation present. And we also had the president of what we have our individual members. So you can be an individual member of the ALDE party. So they individually had a voice within our entire process. So just as we were starting to set up the team, we got a phone call from a certain Anders Fogh Rasmussen, who was like, well, I understand you're putting together a team. Is there, by chance, one more spot? Yeah, okay, we'll make a spot. So he drafted the security and defence part of our manifesto. Former secretary of NATO, it's not a bad starting point. So this committee met, and they discussed what kind of vision they wanted, because nobody in the European Union can vote for the ALDE party. So our manifesto is not going to go directly to the citizens. So what they wanted right from the start was something that would unite all of our liberal parties. We wanted a document that everybody would stand up, beat their chest and say, yes, this is why we're liberals, this is why we work together in Europe, this is what we want. So they started by asking all of our member parties, all 68 of them, what do you want in this manifesto? And they also asked them, what do you not want in this manifesto? Conscious that we don't want to put something in our document that means that they cannot support it, full stop. Our committee then tasked us with organising 10 events around Europe. We did not want to be just talking to ourselves, political parties to political parties. We actually wanted to have a manifesto that's relevant and for the people. So we organised 10, we called them expert forums, but they were topical meetings that were fully public. No politicians were on the panels. These were individuals, experts, people from industry, from business sector, from NGOs, from think tanks. This was getting as much insight as we could on the 10 topics. So we held one on security and defence, climate policy, digitalisation, international trade, the future of EU finance, mobility and infrastructure, human rights, the future of the economic and monetary union, managing migration, and then the social dimension of Europe. So all 10 of these events were conducted publicly. You can watch them back through links on our website. The transcripts are there. And one member of our committee was present at every single one of these meetings. And so after all of this, we had an enormous room full of content and material from our member parties, from our previous policy resolutions, from the ALDE group in the parliament, their voting records, and also the expert outside advice. And basically we tried to fit all that into one document. But because we're Democrats, we put together this document and then we processed it like we do all of our resolutions and send it straight back to our members. And they got the opportunity to amend it fully, and they did. And we went to our Congress, which was held in Madrid in November last year. We had almost 500 amendments, 3 days of long working groups. And we arrived at the paper that we have today, which is our manifesto. Now it's the moment where it finally got in. So you've got the manifesto both in English and Italian in your dossier here, but I'll briefly mention 10 of the key points that have been identified from our manifesto to give you an idea of what's in it. For example, we want to invest in research, security, environment, and tackling youth unemployment. We want to negotiate fair and sustainable international trade deals. We want to establish a new mechanism to monitor and regulate the rule of law in EU member states. We want to create a solid new framework for new technologies in Europe, like blockchain, so that we can harness new technologies for the greater good of citizens. There's a strong digital element in our manifesto, not because it was led primarily by an Estonian, but we want to give each European citizen a secure digital identity and to drive administration more onto a digital basis, just making it easier and transferable. We want to make more migration agreements with safe countries and to work with them to tackle the root causes of the flows to stop people from getting on the boats in the first place. We want to establish more legal ways to Europe for those who seek jobs. We recognise that we cannot become a fortress Europe. We need immigration to continue as we are. We want to strengthen and expand the EU emissions trading system, but we also want to go further and put the Paris Climate Agreement target really in the middle of our policy making. Greater investment in sustainable infrastructure, so we want to have more direct train routes around Europe. We want better highways, we want shorter airline routes so that it saves on the emissions and things like this. And then finally, we want greater transparency in the European institutions, and we call to abolish the Strasbourg seat of the European Parliament, and also to give the European Parliament the right to initiate legislation. So we translate, there are many more bits, but those are 10 which are being picked out as important by quite a few others. We have translated the manifesto upon request. So Pure Europa wanted a copy in Italian, so you have it in Italian. But if you also wanted to read it in Finnish, German, Slovenian, and Swedish, it's on the website. Yeah, that's a small overview of our manifesto and how we got there, and hopefully with a stronger liberal voice in the next parliament, whether Brexit happens or not, the ALDE group is forecast to grow in size. Then you have a certain French president and his party, which hopefully will bolster our numbers, and then our kingmaker spot in the middle will be even more precious to us. Happy to answer any questions, but otherwise.
Well, I think we'll leave. Okay. Thank you very much. Also for being ahead of schedule. I think we're leaving the questions all till the end. And so I'm giving the floor to the next speaker, Monica Frassoni, who's co-president of the European Greens Party. Monica, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Francesco, what do we do? Just an overview of the campaign. It will be helpful than 1,000 words from my side. And thank you to Professor Weber for mettere anche il sound tanto. Se basta, forse sì, forse no.
Ok, c'è un po' di musica, ci sono presentazioni.
Sì, c'è un po' di musica, ma non è anche troppo.
The first one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Try this.
That one?
Yeah,
that one. Oh, it's a bit tough.
Okay.
That one.
Okay, quello che.
No, è che quella cosa se si può collegare
alla cassa.
Non si può mandare per farlo prima, ma.
Sì, si può fare.
Ok, allora io intanto comincio a parlare.
Esatto.
Ok, so hello, my name is Monica Frassoni. I am the co-president of the European Green Party. The European Green Party was the very first party. Which was set up as a European one immediately after the new regulation that my colleague already mentioned. It was created here in Rome in the very big auditorium, and we signed the agreement. In that time I was leader of the group in the European Parliament, the agreement with the 30-something parties in the same room of the, which the Treaty of Rome was signed. So it was a very high moment. Today we are a party which is composed of 46 member parties in all member states of the EU, and I will and beyond that. And probably I will just touch on this question also of the parties which are not members of which belong to countries which are not members of the EU. And we are probably going to touch very briefly when dealing with our European campaign. Something that we are doing also in the European Parliament with our colleagues from our other parties, including the Liberals, the EPP and the Socialists, because Facebook is now having a major work to hinder the European campaign, and this is actually something that can be of interest of all of you, and it is certainly something that is going on now. So it's another element to see what does it mean and how difficult it is to have something so obvious as a European campaign for a European election. So the European Green Party, I can use something that Mr. Burgess said because it is also distinguished, separated from the European Green Group in the European Parliament. But it is very much connected, and I think that what is very important to underline is that one would not be as strong without the other. I mean, the work and the role of the European parties are basically to be. No, actually, it's the other way around. The Green Group, the group in the European Parliament, is the arm of the party at European level. So this is simply the presentation of the campaign. It only lasts a couple of minutes, and I will talk about the priorities later on. So you can. I don't know if you can put
audio
if possible. Otherwise, it's, I don't like very much the music. It's very much boom boom. So. But I think that you can see the priorities we'll talk together. Strange without the sound. This is our leading candidates, I'll talk about it later. So no, it's, so I think that you had a sort of very quick overview about what we want to do. So let me say a few words also in as a comment, if I may, to what Professor Bardi said earlier on. So we make some kind of discussion. Actually, from our point of view, the idea is not to have a discussion between or among parties. And it is not the point of this campaign. It is not to make a consideration or a fight between pro-European and anti-European parties, because we as Greens would be very much in disadvantage in that relation, because we are certainly pro-European, but we are also pro-change. And I believe that we cannot leave to the sovereignists, which is the new name of nationalists, privilege of saying that they want to change Europe, because I think that one of the most important points is certainly to be pro-European, but also to challenge the way in which policymakers of the mainstream parties have been doing Europe today. And one of the saddest things that happened over the last few months over the discussion about the future of Europe, and it will be unfortunately confirmed next Thursday in the summit of Sibiu in Romania, is basically, let's go on as the situation is today, but let's improve the communication and do some other things a bit better, which is exactly what puts us in the current situation. So I think that one of the most important elements of this campaign will be to have a real competition among different options and to make sure that these options are coming out clearly, because whether we like it or we don't like it, one of the most important challenges of these elections is to get the 50% of the people or more, I'm talking about Italy, in Croatia is 70% of the people that don't go to vote, to go to vote. So we have to mobilize, and this is exactly what we have to do if we want to bring people to vote, to make sure that they understand that this is a competition. And what I am saying is not the same as what he is saying, and you have to not seem to say, okay, let's trust the pro-European countries, the parties. No, that's not the point. The point is to make sure that people understand that there are different projects, and that the point is not only to understand how big will be the EPP majority in the European Parliament. That's why I don't agree with Professor Barney, where he said, well, there is really not much to change. I think there will be a lot that will change. Because if the EPP, yes, you said it, if the EPP is going to have to win again, with all due respect with my colleague, which is not here, and I'm not sure that he's not, and I'm sure he's not here by, that it's not an accident that the EPP is not here, is actually they are refusing, which I, it's a bit of a pity, the possibility of having a debate with all of us. That's the same thing at the level of the leading candidate, and it is the that they are refusing basically to participate to the campaign, because they think, okay, we already won, and therefore let's not steer too much with having a debate and putting ourselves in competition, and this I think is already something that should be stigmatized. So I think that there can be a lot of things which change, because if the issue will only be whether the EPP will be in alliance with the socialists or with extreme right, I believe that then it will not be, it means that all of us will not have had a successful campaign, notwithstanding how strong will be the Greens or the Liberals or whatever. What we are striving is to have a majority in the European Parliament that is able to express a commission that is not expressing basically business as usual, both in terms of economic policies and of priorities. So the problem is not the balance between the parties, but it is the issues around which the next European government will be defined. And I think that this is a very key point, because if we only limit to the balance between the parties, then we are doomed. I mean, the people will not be passionate, and they will not follow us, and they will not go into the streets, and the reasons why they're going to the streets are three or four in this moment. One is climate, the other one is rights, the other one is protecting their own rights, whether it is with a nationalist or an anti-migrant agenda or with a more progressive one, but this is what is mobilizing them. So we have to be able to catch them, each from our own point of view, but I think that this is the competition that we have to do on things and on points, on policies that will give a relevance to these elections. Otherwise, we are a little bit in trouble. Now, I also believe that there is another point that has to be very clear in the mind of voters, which unfortunately is not. In our country, it is true that we are speaking a lot, in many other countries as well, but since we are in Italy, I just want to say something about Italy. It is true that we speak more about Europe, but the debate is back to a power struggle between parties, between national parties, really. And we lost a little bit on the way the capacity and the possibility of having a discussion on what's going on in Europe, and this is certainly an issue. Of course, the good point, the good news is that in many countries, and certainly in Italy is the case, the agenda of the European Union has to do with the agenda of the national country, your economic reform, how to deal with a very sleek and weak economy, how on what you decide to invest, what are the priorities for your public spending, how to deal with the low level of education and how to make sure that you can have some kind of improvement there. How do you answer to the fears of a lot of the economic actors? Italy is the second or the third. The French say that now they overcame us. In terms of manufacturing, how you respond to the fears of the producers and of the workers that are really very 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 frustrated about the lack of productivity and about the lack of perspective in even if they have they have a job. So all these issues are very much linked to what the European Union will do. So I think that one of the challenges or one of the ways through which we can bring people to be interested into these elections is also to help them to see that there is a direct link with what they will do on the 26th of May and what they are doing in their opposition or pro-government attitude at national level. Another point that I would like to say that is very important for us is the fact that people understand that at European level there is power. And this power is there to be used. If you don't use it, somebody else will. So the question of determining the majorities is very, very important. And also to determine who will be the people that will actually represent the European policies in Europe. Now, I don't want to overestimate the importance of the European Parliament in this respect, because as we all know, and I will say something about the leading candidate process, the Spitzenkandidat. I don't know why we all say it in German, but it doesn't matter. In English, it's very clear, leading candidate. The point here is that even if it is the member states which determine and nominate the commissioners, the president of the commission is something else, it is a fact that the European Parliament has this extremely interesting process of the public hearings and also of the vote at the end that makes sure that if you are really bad, you better not go, because you will be really exposed. And that over this history, there have been real changes done by different member states, because they would have liked to present this person, but they knew that either because they didn't speak language or because they had no idea or you name it, they really would have not gone through. This does not mean the commissioners are all good, not at all. But at least there is a moment in which there is a public way to check, my God, this chap is really a disaster, or wow, this is really good. And I think that this is something that we should not underestimate in terms of the influence, not only of the parliament, but also of the public. I think that that's something that is certainly very, very important. Now, on the process of the leading candidate, me, I am a little bit, let's say, between two chairs, because in 2014, we as Greens were among the very big supporters of this process, and we still are, of course. In this, I probably have some discrepancy with my co-chair, which is Rainer Butikofer, who is a member of the European Parliament from Germany. Because we saw this as a way through which we could take out, a little bit like a public hearing in a way, from the simple, the hands of the council and from the hands of the member state government, the process of nomination of the European Commission president. And also a way to give a certain protagonism to the parties, to the European parties, to what we are. It is true we don't have the transnational list yet, but at least this process could, with the public debates, with the fact that these guys had to go all over Europe to make campaign, and also of course the fact that who wins in the European Parliament and gets the post, which was the case in 2014. I think that today the situation is a little bit more complicated than it was in 2014, we cannot just make the complete economy of who are the candidates that are being nominated. I mean, it's not the same. Whereas in 2014, the idea was the different member parties nominated people, the one who wins, that's it. And we are all behind, of course, in Parliament, we all voted differently, but let's say the process is recognized and legitimate as such. This time, the process is also legitimate because the parties have not all, but most chosen leading candidates. We always have nominate two. I am a co-president. We have two co-spokes, two co-leading candidates, Ska Keller and Bas Eickhout. This is something that helps very much in the diversification, not only of gender, but also of approach, of culture, and also gives, according to me, a better quality of leadership. I've been a co-leader for some time now, and I can tell you that the fact of sharing and having to confront constantly with somebody else is something that does not only help the quality of life, because you can share, but also the quality of leadership, and I'm very, very convinced about it. I know that in Italy and in other places it is not very popular, but I really believe that it's not only a question of gender, it's also a question of quality of leadership. But what will happen after the elections? I think that a lot of us are very worried, and I'm sorry that my colleague from the EPP is not there, that in case the EPP is still the first party, we are simply in a mathematical way give to Weber the presidency of the Commission. I think that that is something that we should really think through, and we should also certainly discuss with other parties, and that's why the campaign is so important. Because we have to make sure that there can be an alternative majority, and that there can be a majority that doesn't simply say, okay, the first party gets the post of the president of the Commission. We will see. You know, it's simply that I'm simply say that probably this year is not so mathematical, it's not so clear cut and accepted as such. I think that the campaign is still to be done, and the results are still to be seen. And so I think that after that, we'll see what will happen. Now, I just wanted to say a few words now on what we are actually aiming at as Greens. Perhaps just very quickly, we are now the fifth group in the European Parliament. So you may say, "Bof, it's a bit small." But we have two major points that make us stronger than what we look. First is that we are extremely united, and we are a diverse group inside the European Greens. It's not only European Greens, it's called European Greens European Free Alliance, because it is an alliance, basically, of green parties, of regionalist party, and also of the pirates and a couple of independents. And here I must say that the fact of being so united made sure that in some issues that are very important for us, climate, energy, rights, privacy, where we had a really important role, migration, we were able, of course, not all of us, only of us, but to create mobile alliances that allowed us to win. You were mentioning some of those wins. Across the different lines. You would not believe that in some cases we would make an alliance with the Liberals, in other cases with the EPP, most of the cases with Socialists, and in some cases with the Left. I think that that's the beauty of the European Parliament as well, the fact that you can actually play with the different priorities according to the different topics. That's why topics are so important in the discussion at European level, because we're not talking simply about schieramenti, about fronts, but we are talking really about topics and about the capacity of cross-cutting among the national delegations or the national priorities. Another thing that makes us a little bit stronger is the fact that we normally don't work through national delegations. It's not that the national delegation is one-sided. We try to work as a group as such. That's why me, as an Italian, I was able to be leader for a long time, even if my own delegation was only two, and now there is only one. So it's not something that has to do with how strong the delegation is, but it's a little bit more on really, once again, the topics, the capacity, etc. So I think that is also something that is handy when you work at the level of the European level, the European Parliament, because you can really discuss not only from your own national party, but you can also do it as European as such. So just to finish up with the issues, you have here the 12 priorities that were a little bit, we decided to make it short with 12 priorities. We also have a longer manifesto that you can find on europeangreens.eu. There are three very big lines that have to be mentioned. One is the fight on climate change, the second is a question of rights, and the third is democracy. we understood and we saw that if you are an eco-skeptic, somebody who denies the importance of climate change, you are bound to be somebody against the rights of women or the rights of gays. And it is really true, we mentioned it, we measured it. And you are notably very, very often an anti-European. It is not always the case, but we see that the certain characteristics are there. So all these fights are linked. And we believe that in order to fight climate change, you cannot not talk about social policies. And in order to have a sustainable social policy, you cannot but describe an industrial economic policy that goes in the direction of limiting and managing the effects of climate change. So because there are these two elements are very, very much going together. You want to reduce very strongly the emissions, but you also want to describe policies that are able to mitigate the effects of climate change that are there, whether you like them or not. The fact that there is no water, there is drought, is certainly an impact of the climate change, but you have to manage it now. So, for example, in our country, we have an average of about 60% of pipes which do not work. You can fight climate change and do remission, etc., but if you don't repair the pipes, you are bound to be much more let's say, affected by climate change than if you had a perfect water system by which your droughts will be perfectly managed. So it is not, once again, it's not only about macro policies like stop coal within 2030 or stop fossil fuels subsidies, but it is very much an issue of everyday policies and everyday management of this situation. The second point is rights, which concerns everything that has to do with our own as European citizens, but also the ones of migrants, with this idea of human migration policy, which sounds nice, but is extremely concrete, and which has passes through the reform of the Treaty of Dublin, which has been done basically by the European Parliament, and the opening of legal ways and legal channels for work migration. And then the third and last is the question of the European democracy, which has to do very much with the way in which the European Union works. We do not believe that it is not possible to have a reform of the EU. We believe that the European Parliament has the power to propose and to start and to initiate this reform. This parliament, the outgoing parliament, has been fearful to do it. They did nothing, almost nothing, in terms of proposing new changes. And I think that one of the challenges of the next one is to be able to start. You don't want to call it constitutional, call it Filippo, I don't care. But the question of reforming the EU, of making it more democratic, of getting rid as much as possible of the veto right, and is really something that should be very high on our agenda, and that is linked to what I was saying before. You cannot have a green taxation, for example, if you don't remove the veto. You cannot have a social policy if you don't proceed on certain issues that have to do also with the European competences. You cannot go up with the budget of the EU if you don't include some kind of possibility of having income. Even if on this there is a discussion, it is possible even today to introduce EU level taxation on plastic, on CO2. It's simply that you don't have the majority to do it, and you need, and the Parliament has been doing this a lot in the past, has stopped doing it over the last years, and you need a dynamic. And it was a dynamic that created the co-decision of the Parliament, it was a dynamic that created the Convention, it was a dynamic that created a lot of improvement that started from somewhere. So I think that this next Parliament should not be so shy in being a constituent Parliament, even if you don't like the word constituent, constitution, you call it whatever, but I really think that this should be one point that is quite important, and perhaps linked to this, and this will be my final point, is the role of the EU at a global level, not only in terms of being able to be united in the climate issues, but also to speak with one voice in terms of arms trade, to have a real code in terms of peace, and of course, as I said before, in the policies of asylum and migration and cooperation. So this is a little bit what we are striving to do in the next elections, And in Italy, we are presenting ourselves with a list, a common list called Europa Verde, with five female head of the list. And in the rest of the EU, we are present, each with its own name. But we are certainly one of the political families, together with the liberals, which are on the rise.
Thank you very much, President Frassoni. As I heard you speak, I didn't think we disagreed so much, but this is something for us to talk about later.
Was a bit provocative.
You know, I don't want to start a debate now. I will only add one thing, since Christian Kramer is not here, to what you said about the what's going to happen with the Spitzenkandidat afterwards. I'm conducting now a study on the EPP group, and I see them routinely. They're very much aware that it's not going to be the same thing as in 2014.
I'm sure.
Okay, so, you know, just as a matter of information. Now we have Anja Schwipek, who is Senior Policy Advisor at the Foundation for European Progressive Studies. Anja, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much, Luciano, and thank you very much for having me here. It's an absolute privilege, and I think, you know, quite an exciting debate, because even if we're missing some representatives here, and I know, you know, it would be a lot of fun for everyone if we had someone with whom we would profoundly disagree and immediately, and it would get into a massive fight. I think an exciting part of this exercise is that you've had someone who works for the party. You've heard someone who is leading the parliamentary group, and I represent, so to say, yet another subsection of each of the political families, because I am a research fellow at the Foundation for European Progressive Studies, which is a think tank connected to Social Democrats. I also think, you know, geographically we represent very different approaches, so by all means, this is pretty much how every European debate should look like. So, you know, it's an absolute pleasure to be here. I think, you know, Luciano started from saying that, you know, these elections are very different to any other election. I mean, I don't want to be a bore, but we say it before every single election, that this election is very much historical. But this one probably is so because it is seeing a drastically different context than any election before. It's true that when we come to the European elections, it is always the question, and Monica Frassoni already mentioned before the issue of turnout, and which got somewhere stabilized, but it's still not ideal turnout at all. And if we look at the countries like Slovakia, I mean, 1 in 10 people going to vote, I mean, you know, it's not an act of democracy and responsibility, really. But by every single election, there is a question being popped if the European Union still makes sense, since people do not go and vote. It never happens on the national level. I mean, even if the turnout in Italy would be 20%, nobody would say, well, are we giving up on Italy? You know, it still would be just a political choice. Well, when it comes to the European Union, it is a question of existence of the European Union very much. And I think no other legislative period, as much as the one that we are finishing just now, has been so much characterized with the existential question about the future of the community. And I think, you know, if nothing else, and if even if you do not want to take statistics on that, I think the number of speeches from different political groups that have been held on the issue of the future of Europe, I mean, Theresa May, you know, Antonio Costa, Macron, you know, you name it, everybody held a speech, everybody picked a university and held a speech pretty much. So this is our equivalent of that in one way or another. But there has been a lot of existential questions about Europe, and of course the context of United Kingdom and the fact that something unthinkable, so negotiations of getting out of the European Union, has put the sense of urgency. I think additional thing, and that has been said already a lot, the theory about the European elections is that this is the second rank elections, so it's never about Europe really, it's about many other things. But I think it is changing a lot, because the national politics has gotten extremely a lot of European elements, especially since the crisis. And additionally to that, this is a certain end of permissive consensus. And while the last elections may have been very much characterized with people's anger after the crisis and anger with the politics, established politics, and Luciano Bardi, whom I very much agree about, you know, worrying signals regarding the traditional party politics. And I do represent, as my colleagues, you know, my colleagues started with saying how old they're
European parties are. I could join very much this statement about the, you know, age of the political parties, but I think the problem is not even that much of an age, but in how far they become part of the system that people are starting to have more and more a problem with. And in that sense, I think that there is a different nature of the protest, of the contest today. I mean, the entire environmental manifestations that we are having are of a different kind of a nature, because those people are not protesting to be heard, but they do believe that they have power themselves to change the nature of politics. And here is a very big thing for the connection between the society and politics. Having said that, I mean, I do not want to go into structural issues, because I think that after the presentation of my two colleagues, you pretty much, if you hadn't been familiar with how the European political families are composed, you pretty much see that this is kind of a model that sort of repeats with the different diversities in itself. But I'd like to focus a bit on the changes that we have within the context of the European elections, because I think that this context is very explanatory when it comes to political proposals, and I'd like to talk politics today. Because even though I'm from a think tank, so I cannot campaign, so do get me booed if you feel that I'm starting to lobbying on you. That's not at all what I am intending or even allowed by law to do. But I still would like to discuss with you a couple of political proposals, because I think indeed, you know, politics is not about semantics. It is about ideological profound difference, you know, something that gets us to believe that it's worth engaging to change the world. Because in the end of the day, politics is all about the nature of changing the world to be a better place. I think, you know, last time around we saw for the first time the experiment with the top candidates, and I agree very much with Monica Frassoni that by the geographical proximity of the last time around candidates, we started calling it Spitzenkandidaten. Now it's changing slightly in the dialectics, but that brought two very exciting dynamics. Number one, it brought a closer connection between what is federal pillar on the European Union and intergovernmental. And in the light of the discussion we had this morning, the Europe of Nations or Federal Europe, this is an important experiment. And the second thing, it has brought a certain presidentialization of the European elections. Because, you know, of course, not everybody is watching Florence or Maastricht debate, but suddenly this European political family started having the faces. And in case of, for example, Social Democrat, the top candidate, is de facto a leader of a political party for the campaign. Now, our colleagues have changed now the approach. There's more a team approach. I think it's interesting, and it's too early to say, in how far then we are going to look only at the presidentialization of the election, so the appointment of the top candidate, that's part of the story. But maybe we are going to see a politicization of the generally, the process of having the commission as such. I mean, there has been already, you know, the commission is apolitical. But today, the power is the power of initiative, you know, the people who represent certain political parties within the commission. So I think, you know, this experiment with the leading candidate versus the team is an interesting dynamic. We ourselves, we have a leading candidate, that's Frans Timmermans, I think very much known as a, you know, fighter for democracy and rights. This is our candidate, this is the leader of the party for the current moment. I think that what is important is this question of also that change is the question of the why, what do you put forward in the manifesto, and I'll talk about that in a moment, but also the question of the nature of the context. And I mean, I come from Poland, so don't make mistake about that. For me, the democracy and anti-democracy is not semantics. No. I mean, what's happening in my country is the anti-democratic trend, and this is only within the 30 years of my own life that is happening, and it's making a massive difference. The reason for which those elections are therefore so important is because if the anti-governmental forces are going to get inside of the European Parliament, they are going to have access to the resources, they are going to have access to the media attention, and they are going to be formally embedded in the political context, which is why the fight for democracy and the fight for a different quality of politics is so important, because otherwise those guys will not have early elections, nothing of that kind. It will be 5 years solidly funded political attention. So these elections, therefore, are extremely important. This is the context in which I think all the manifestos are being built. And here I'd like to say a couple of things about, you know, how we came conceptually to the position that we are in. Of course, the European elections are slightly different than the national elections. When you write your national manifesto, it's pretty much down to be on the leaflet, and it's pretty much down to be given to every single activist that goes on the street and speaks with the people. Now, I don't particularly like the notion with the people, because that already sort of, in a very patronizing way, says, you know, us and the people. I think, you know, we might be slightly abnormal because we are obsessed with politics. That's, of course, the case. But nevertheless, you know, it should be from the people, by the people, for the people, so to say. European elections are different because these manifestos are produced in a different way, and the colleagues have already explained the process in their parties. But the manifestos are first and foremost the key symbol of a unity of a political family that is adopted once per 5 years regarding the future of the European Union. And this symbol is a very important thing. Let me give you the example of the history of my own political family, Social Democrats. The first elections, 1979, we did not adopt the manifesto because we simply couldn't agree. We adopted a letter to the electorate, and that was all we could agree. Until 1990s, we had quite a lot of footnotes and disclaimers because the political parties would disagree with one or another notion in the manifesto. So the fact that today the political parties are coming and are being able to unite is an interesting degree of political unification within the political families, and I don't think it should be underestimated, because indeed it is very hard to reach that dimension. Secondly, it's of course the question of, you know, the candidate and the platform that the candidate states on, the question of coherence. And I think we've learned, especially as Social Democrats, the lesson from last time around, because Martin Schulz, who was our candidate in 2014, had a specific manifesto by himself, and then we had the PES manifesto, which was a separate from that. So I think, you know, this time around we do have one manifesto, but the other political groupings, and they are not essentially represented at this table, they do go still for the two, saying, okay, then it's much more of personal touch. Now, for us, it is very clear that manifesto is the agreement of all the party that this is what we stand for, this is what we are going to campaign on, and this is also the guarantee that the candidates along will be coherent when it comes to Europe. Of course, the messages on the national level will be nationally defined one way or another, but nevertheless. So, symbol of a unity platform from the candidate, and also the basis of a discussion. And I think, you know, we will disagree when it comes to specificities of the European solutions, and I hope we are going to get into that. But if you take the manifesto of the European Greens, of ALDE, of EPP, of Social Democrats, and you put them on the top of one another, and you sort of, you know, disregard the particular narrative, political narrative that we will have, you will get a very interesting list of questions that will be sort of similar, differently tackled, but similar. And I think that for anybody reading the manifesto, it's an important list of issues that certainly will become the cornerstones of the next legislative period in terms of politics. So we already, you know, discussed part of them this morning, but I want to move on to them today. Now, when it comes to Social Democratic Manifesto, we've had pretty much a lengthy and open process. But also learning from 2014 elections, we decided that our manifesto will play a different role than the manifesto in the past. So we had a very broad discussion. I mean, our colleagues from Liberals had fora. I think pretty much everyone have tried to consult the text and the different ideas and be open in terms of developing of the manifestos, we as well. And with that, we arrived to 7 resolutions, thematic resolutions, which were very broad document that were adopted at the Congress of Lisbon in December last year. From that, we created a manifesto, which is 4 pages long, and it's in this document. We would love that to be even shorter, but, you know, after 500 amendments or 5,000 amendments that usually hit this kind of a text, it's very difficult to go slower and lower than 4 pages. But this is not it. Manifesto is just the basis, it's a direction, it's a symbol. But what we are working currently on is what we call the governing program for the European Commission, because we believe that whichever alliance, and Monica Frassoni was discussing about, you know, alliance based on the issues and so on, we believe that if we want to improve the quality of the European politics, any alliance, commission, parliament, institutional alliance should be based on something that would be more of a political platform, not that we agree because we need to divide in between ourselves certain positions. Is it my time limit?
No, dal parcheggio sterrato riservato agli studenti, la Fiat Multipla targata B439WR.
Well, I very much enjoyed this commercial break. But so what we would agree is that any sort of alliance, because what people demand is not simply a, you know, musical chairs kind of a discussion about who is being the leader of one or another thing, but actually a proper program that is based on political compromise on the issues. In our sense, and this is the main motto of the program that we are having for this time, what we believe what happened around the crisis and post-crisis, and that's why also the permissive consensus around Europe has been broken, is the fact that European Union stopped representing people's dream, something that people would believe that would be an added value and bring something more to improve their lives, to protect them against all the different challenges, digitalization, climate change, you know, all the things that have already been mentioned this morning, and would offer them opportunities, access to knowledge, access to chances to have better future. Which is why the Social Democratic Manifesto this year is based on the premises of a social contract. We would believe that the European Union of the future should become the one based on the social contract, and social contract would represent across the board, so would be the social contract for the young people, taking responsibility for them, for the middle-aged one, for the elderly one, for whichever. It would be a complex thing, and I would say that this is our way of looking at modernization of democracy as well, looking at Europe and how Europe can deliver to people. In that sense, the manifesto might not be this very lengthy visionary document, but I also explained why this is a sort of a mid-document in between the process of developing diverse character of the political agenda. But it is a very acute list of what we would believe answers, showing the responsibility, an idea of taking responsibility for Europe in terms of very main questions. I'm not going to go one by one. I mean, you all can read this manifesto, but let me tell you why I believe this manifesto is actually an important and interesting document. First and foremost, it actually takes onward the discussion about inequalities. I think everybody spoke about inequalities in the last couple of years. This has been a sort of a hashtag. But it takes the issue of inequalities in the very specific brackets, showing what the European Union can do about inequalities. Of course, we are social democrats, so it's not going to be a surprise that we talk about the issues such as minimum wage, the issue of equal pay for equal work, and the question of taxation, especially the equalizing the chances in terms of taxation between, you know, labor and capital, if you want to use a bit of maybe some philosophical language as such. The second thing that the manifesto definitely looks at is the question of sustainable Europe. We are not competing with the Greens, even though I'm wearing a green collar very much. And you know, Frans Timmermans said in his campaign, "Vote Green," which I think is going to be a lapsus for the entire European campaign, so to say. I think that this is an important issue, and we might disagree in terms of particularities on sustainability, how to build a sustainable model for the European Union. But I think the question of just transition is a question that cuts across both the labour market, the issue of fairness in terms of generation, solidarity, agriculture, the need for the reform of agriculture policy, all the issues that are key and important. The question of gender equality, we have been talking about that a lot, but of course post-2008 gender equality has been slightly dropped on the agenda because there was a lot of narrative about how you cannot afford proper social and employment policies that would be also empowerment policies. So this time around Social Democrats are coming up with a very strong notion of having the binding gender pact for Europe. We are looking at the question of the young generations. We have been quite obsessed with the question of the youth unemployment or youth employment pact, the question of Erasmus, of course, how to make it more broad and accessible for everyone, but also the issues such as child poverty. I mean, it's a scandalous thing that Europe, and someone said it, quoting today, this morning, the global agenda, that Europe is such a prosperous continent in the end of the day, and the rates of child poverty are growing and growing. This is going to hindering the chances for Europe even more than what happened to the younger generation just in the midst of crisis. I think an important point is, of course, the question of democracy, and I think it comes to a very much degree to our surprise, because if you asked for the estimates half a year ago what these elections would be about, I would probably bet on the fact that the anti-European forces would try to make it about everything that divides us, so migration would be on the top, and we would be trying to make it about everything that unites us, so we would be probably going about the issues of democracy. And I would say that even though all our manifestos in very different way are very strong in promoting diverse democratic solutions, today morning we had a discussion about, you know, the need of the European Parliament to strengthen its power of initiative. There's a question of also, you know, the budgetary empowerment of the European Parliament, the issue of empowerment of the civil society. Nevertheless, this part of the discussion isn't exactly as present as we would like. And I think that it is an important thing that the European Parliament and the European Commission will need to take on, because my country, to give an example, cannot, of course, be let run free with all the things that we've done against democracy as such. Last but not least, I think a very important point that we have, we've always believed in a global Europe. This morning we spent quite a bit of time talking about the issue of the defence. In terms of our manifesto, we are more about the question of migration as part of the issue, because this is a historical test for humanity about how we're going to go about migration, and the sense of urgency is still there. But of course also the issue of trade and the issue of the new pact for Africa. I think there is no doubt around this table that this is going to be something that is going to pretty much define the next mandate in the European Parliament, the issue of how Europe now redefines its relations with the other continent. Those are just a couple of building blocks, but I think, you know, we can talk, of course, about the details, but just highlighting them, I'd like to say that, you know, there's a lot of ambition. And just on the final point, I already said I cannot campaign, so I cannot convince anybody to anything, really, in this room. but while not campaigning, I'd like to say that the mood, at least for us, in terms of political family, has changed dramatically from what we were starting this campaign with. I think half a year ago, you know, we were getting into this campaign in a sort of a sense of responsibility that we have to, because it's a European campaign, but maybe our sense of confidence wasn't exactly on the high level. Now, recent elections in Finland and in Spain have, of course, been boosting our sense of optimism. We also think that Frans Timmermans have been doing enormously engaged campaign. He's the only sole candidate, so we can't spread him as the colleagues with the team across Europe, but we think still that he has been quite present. And of course, what helps is that he speaks X number of languages and he debates in all of them. But I also think that with the elections that just happened, and referring to also what Monica Frassoni before was talking about, you know, anti-European forces and their percentage, I think that we need to once again get to realize that the fear of those forces becoming the disruptive part of the process is actually grander than when we look at the statistics today. I do believe in reason among people. I am a social democrat, so I will always be optimistic about, you know, power of people to see beyond. I think there is a lot of richness in terms of political ideas. I don't think that the European political parties are having intellectual crisis. I think we are having a certain crisis of confidence when it comes to approaching European electorate. And I think that if we go slightly beyond, and if the optimism that at least, you know, five of us are broadcasting from this side of the table that Europe is still worth bothering for, is going to transcend, I do think that people will respond, because I think that, you know, there is a chance of building a union that can be also a project for the new generation. I think that has been 20 minutes. Polish 20 minutes, not Italian 20 minutes. Thank you for your attention.
You still have a couple of minutes, because you were excited to have it 25, but anyway. Thank you very much, Annie, for your presentation. Thanking again the other two speakers for their excellent contributions. Now, the enviable task of commenting on these very inspiring and interesting presentations goes to Paolo Bognoni and I, Bognoni, sorry, and I ask him to comment and ask questions, maybe even. Mm-hmm. We could start the debate. Huh?
Yeah, let me pose.
Sorry.
Yes, no, it's fine. Yes, let me start from...
if you push the button, it's better.
No, I think it was... Oh,
no,
it was not pushed.
Green light.
Yeah. So you were not using it, actually.
Well, then I have a very dominant
voice,
yes.
You actually do. You are affected. I would have liked to comment on... I have a few remarks of more... let's say, historical character of historical side, historical distorted sort, in the sense of seeing starting from one question, which I, as far as I understood, Bardige also posed that whether there are some elements leading to a decline or a crisis of democracy surfacing again after the first 4 years in which democracy was strengthened, maybe the last, if not 40, at least 20 years, probably leading the tendency into the opposite direction. What I would like to start from is a survey by European Council of Foreign Relations called "What Europeans Really Want," and this survey is debunking some of the myths about what Europeans really want, but also confirms some of the alarming tendencies. 46,000 electors from 14 member countries were interviewed, and the good news are that I don't know whether they are positive or negative, but what one is that it's not necessarily Central and Eastern Europeans are being more Eurosceptic, not necessarily, but it is not good news, because that just simply means that a lot of also in the Western part, so also in the older member countries, look at my own countries where we are now, Italy, Euroscepticism or disappointment, to say the least, is very much growing. And probably, though, I'm not getting deeper into this, but apparently is the central focus is probably not immigration. It remains one of the main ones, but it's not the most central focus of this election for Europeans. What do they think? They have been then classified in four different tendencies. Two of the tendencies are more or less positive. 24% are called the system preservers of some kind. They are cautiously positive, or maybe on the other side, so disillusioned about any other possibility of renewal that they would rather keep the system as it is. Right. And we have heard a lot this morning about the fact that it cannot continue as it is for many reasons. So I don't know how positive this is of a support of sorts. 24% of them are positive about the EU, and they come mostly from the most affluent layers of European society, and mostly from the most successful countries, European member countries, like Germany or Denmark, for instance. This is also interesting as a Scandinavian, is that a country like Denmark or Sweden, even having belonged to the traditional Eurosceptics, you know, has this change of tendency actually. The last positive news are coming from the 38%, which have been classified as the gilets jaunes of the whole of Europe, deeply lacking any confidence, or being deeply skeptical about both their own national and the EU level of politics. And they have, we have 14% people, mostly in the older, belong to the older generations, cohorts, who would rather go back to national states as they used to be. And one should wonder if this level of, if the state thinks is ideal in order to propel what should be a great leap forward of EU institutions in whatever direction. I would say, I would agree with Fabio Mazzini this morning that the functionalist approach is not enough anymore. But is this state of things in the European public and electorate enough to, in order to propel this? Is there confidence enough, so to say? And why is there not confidence enough? Let's start. I would like to start from one of the successful cases of the last years, which is Portugal. Portugal has been able to keep inside the limits, the parameters, thanks to the fact that they challenged one of the tenets of the last decades, that is that people won't take any raise in taxes at all. This is apparently not true. The taxes were raised there from 34.4 to 35.4%. So this has been challenged, and the government, as you all know, is quite popular, and the Socialist Party is one also very popular. Although we must say that they were starting from a quite low level of taxation, right? We are all above all other countries which have been got forward in building up their welfare states or whatever. Have a higher level of taxation. Although, for instance, the Nordic countries have cut this level to levels which are now comparable with Italy, for instance. See Sweden and so on. on a few things, then the Portuguese government wouldn't compromise, and it was the cuts for the weaker. Benefits for the weaker social layers of society, and then higher pensions. That was needed for higher pensions, higher minimum wages, and a lower retirement age for public employees. So, what Costa has done and the Socialist Party has done there is trying to keep, and that's the Socialist Party, but that would go for any other kind of parties in office, try to keep support group layers in society, away from being damaged by policies of the last decades. Still, there is one problem with how long this Portuguese model can be sustainable in the long run, and which tells us a lot about what I believe a lot of the party growth programs are, I believe, not mentioning this fundamental problem of ideology and or national interest of some member countries at least. In order to achieve all that I have mentioned and keep within the limits, Portugal has cut public investment in a dramatic way. In 1960, public investment was 5.4% of BNP, and in 2016 was 1.6%. Right. Now it's risen a little bit the last couple of years. This is also to be ascribed to one of many of the positive decisions taken by Costa government. It was a slight improvement, but the FMI holds that what's happening in public investment in Portugal is an overall minus 1.2% net balance, so to say. So So the problem is what? The problem is in a way that we are in a long-term situation which has to do with a form of ideology. Europe has been built around in the last 25 years, which is not acknowledging that growth must have two motors, two engines. Export on the one side, very fine, but also long-term and investment linked to domestic demand. The latter is not acknowledged, taken care of enough, and this is a very big problem for several reasons I would like to say, which don't simply have to do with socioeconomic problems, but in my view also with the way we have built European democracies in the past. I think this is contributing to the fact that people don't see, a lot of people in Europe don't see enough room, enough potential for upward social mobility anymore. And as some Swedish sociologists call it, on the basis of also some British surveys, they keep looking sideways. Looking sideways, that's what it's called. That is to say, they keep looking sideways. They have given up the hope of looking upwards. They've given up the hope of upward social mobility. And what they do, they're looking sideways in a sense, at least I don't want to be taken over by somebody else coming from below. From outside, you know what I mean. And this is simply, this situation is simply ideal for national populists. For a few decades, we have had a totally different situation. I was last week invited to comment Adam Przeworski's, I think it's the right pronunciation.
Przeworski.
Yeah. Book, Why Bother to Vote? And he's showing very clearly a graph at page 42, I can even remember, in which you can see that democratic elections are adopted in a growing number of countries between the 19th and the first couple of decades of the 20th century. So you have a slight increase. And then this in the interwar period. This increase simply stops, you know. And then you have a very steep increase in tendency after World War II. Now, what I believe is that what we have managed to do in those 40 years after World War II is that we have conceived a society and an economy pushed forward with both the engines of growth, domestic demand, which is made of welfare state, long-term investment, and export. Very intertwined factors. The fact that you nowadays you have, as we have seen also by some examples this morning, you have much more a tendency to volatile, unreliable investment and a cut in welfare state in most places makes it so that unlike in those 40 years, participated organizations are not addressed anymore in order to negotiate the size and the quality of this investment, long-term investment. Which was therefore back then also empowering democracy and organizations where grassroots slowly became selected to become crafted politicians. And then around this long-term investment, then what you had a distinction between the interests, for instance, and you just mentioned capital and labor. And then you had two phases. You had compromise in the end, but you started from distinction. You had distinction and then compromise, which is enriching a democracy, clearly, right? I'm afraid that what we have now is a partnership around rather untouchable or too little touchable or the liberal roots. This has affected, first of all, social democratic parties, which, as we all know, were in office around 2000. But now, as we can see the changing of this social model, of this European social model, as we could call it, as we have built it after World War II, in some countries even earlier, Nordic countries beginning with the 30s, avoiding the falling back into fascism, for instance. What we are seeing is that also mainstream liberal democratic or liberal conservative parties are losing their own votes. They are losing their hold on their own social layers. You can see that in many. The last example you have is the local election in Britain, for instance, where the Tories lose dramatically. But I can mention, for instance, you mentioned Finland, the Social Democrats won the election by 0.2.
But still.
And the second part. No, no. But let me mention this because it shows a lot. It says a lot. It says a lot about what we are facing, what challenges we are facing. That party. Was the right-wing version of the already National Populist Party, which was in the government coalition in office with the Centre Party and the Conservatives in Finland. They jumped out of that already rather right-leaning coalition on a much more radical agenda, and they got 17%. And they got 17%. A lot of those votes coming from one of the most successful center or center-right parties, moderate parties, typical as they called it, Nordic countries, bourgeois party, in the 40s after World War II, the center party in Finland, which collapsed down to 13%. We have seen another example of that in Spain, right, where the Popular Party. Is losing to Vox Party, which is plainly nostalgic party, right? One of the main analyses about why we haven't national populist tendencies in Germany also, but in Spain and Portugal was that, well, their fascist past was so close and so terrible, right? Well, it's apparently not true anymore in Spain.
Vox,
right?
It's only 10%.
Yeah. It's only 10%. It's only 10%. It's only 10% rising from nil 2 years ago. Right? Like in Sweden, Lega Nord has taken 30 years to build up what they have now. Sverigedemokraterna in Sweden has just taken, in one of the most solid democracies, has taken only 3 elections to build up 20% of the popular share. So we are facing something unprecedented, and I've tried to enlist some of the socio-historical, maybe too economistic, reasons for that. Thank you.
Okay. We have 45 minutes. We have to vacate this room.
30 minutes.
What, 4? 45? Oh, now it's down to 30 minutes? Okay, fine. No problem. but anyway, it's good time for debate. I will start taking questions from the floor. gentleman here, and then who else? Three, four, let's five. Let's stop with this for now. Please, you were first, yes.
I wanted to ask you...
No, the guy in front of you was first.
Apologies.
Yeah.
Dave, first of all, and I rather have...
Can you say your name so we know?
Sure, certainly. I'm Urošević, I'm a third-year global governance student here at the University of Podgorica, and I'm originally from Belgrade, Serbia. I have a really maddening proposition, like a radical proposition that I would like to hear your opinions on, and I'll first actually direct my question to Ms. Pasoni, the co-president of the Green European Party, is... As a counterweight, since you are certainly not a political rights aspect of any sort, do you see Salvini's party and the Lega Nord kind of emerging as the leaders of the center-right in Europe as a cause of these elections? That is my question. And then my proposition of radically changing the way the European Parliament works... In regards of what if we held several elections split into five or seven categories, let's say environment and sustainability, security and defense, economic and monetary policy, like we have five or seven categories that encompass everything. And instead of holding one election and creating a parliament out of different European parties or joint parties, we had a system where for environment and sustainability, we have one election and the two top parties or the three top parties passing the census of, let's say, 5%. Get to enact their policies together. And what if we did the same thing for defense and security? What if we did it for foreign policy? What if we did it for monetary policy? And I think this way we spur and we force cooperation between these parties, and we also give the people a choice of saying, well, we like this in your manifesto, but we don't like this in your manifesto. Thank you.
Okay. Francesco.
Thank you very much, Francesco Vega. I can't resist. I said this before yesterday, and I have to repeat in front of representatives of our political families. I think we do have the greatest opportunity ever. And this opportunity is given us by the fact that we are probably facing something that we have never experienced before. A little step back, I take only 1 minute. 1989, a world crashed down, and some political parties did not realize that the way they were doing politics was referring to an old world was going to disappear. So they were acting just like there was one part against the other. World was changing, and parties that 50% decreased to 45, 40, okay, something is going on, 30, same parties now among 15% of voters. So they did lose something. Something has changed. And something disappeared. Some parties disappeared also. Same thing today, maybe. So the new European Parliament that is going to be elected in the forthcoming elections will have to face something that has never experienced before. A leading role for Europe in the world that is provoking the best reactions and the worst reactions. So a leading Europe causes forces against that spread everywhere, and forces promoting them. At the end, political parties, political forces, do they have to change in this environment in order to grasp the opportunity that this is coming to them? So it's a very tricky question. It doesn't take too much time, but I would love to hear what our speakers think about that. Thank you.
Now, the gentleman behind the Serbian gentleman.
I'm David Ball, I'm from Italy, and I'd like to ask two questions. One directly to Mr. Burgess, if I may. In your opinion, how will the ALDE group change, the ALDE party change after Macron's party entrance in the next EU parliament, because Macron is represented as a symbol of a dreamer, of a revolutionary in Europe, a huge reformist. This is the rhetoric around his name. And so are there going to be any difference from the current state of main policy around the ALDE group? And the second question to the main speakers is a general question about the kind of political debate we have in Italy first, but all around in Europe, because in my opinion, it's quite frustrating that during a European election debate, we discuss only domestic policies. In Italy, I think it's quite crazy to have many interviews in TV or radios, and probably the main question or the main debate is about nowadays Armando Siri, that is a junior minister, but we have lots of more to discuss about Europe, to change Europe in a way or another, but this is not because of an Italian provincialistic or narrow-minded approach towards Europe, because I think if we look at UK, the current debate is about a second referendum or a sort of return match between Brexiteers and Remainers, or if we look around to France, it's like a return match of a presidential debate between Le Pen and Macron, or the same thing in Spain. They had a general election and now they're trying to form a government. And the main domestic policies about independence or nationalistic approach towards the Catalonian crisis is on the table. And I think this is the main weakness of European policy, because if we vote on domestic policy, on domestic leaders, it's quite useful pointless to have European elections. So when, in your opinion, will finally come time when we have a clear debate with transnational list, clear manifesto, clear proposal, clear face on it, and probably a mandatory approach to the procedure to elect the commissioner, the leader of the European Commission. Thank you.
Andrew.
It was very much on the same lines, but I still would like to say something. Taking on that, do you think maybe the other experience is a little bit different, but do you think that the national components in your political families are actually more a liability than an asset? Because we discussed today and perhaps even yesterday, the still dominant power of the nation, government, national government, member states in the structure of the European Union is very much what is stopping from reaching several achievements, let's say, or innovations or reforms. And personally, I do see the same in most of the countries. People do not vote for European Parliament. They vote to punish their governments or to send away people. This is very much the case of France, I know for sure, or to uproot somebody from their national political party into a more visible position. So I think the manifestos are a very good step forward in trying to reach out to the citizens of Europe, the European Union, and say, do vote on how we would like to make things and not on the faces or the political affiliation. But would you say that this is enough? Definitely need to create proper European parties and get rid of any national link like we're possibly doing, because that is really toxic.
Daniel.
I have before a general comments on very important issues that have been directly or indirectly mentioned by our speakers and by Paolo Borioni, that is something about the legitimation of European Union according to the results of these of the next elections. And I was thinking already yesterday in the debate about the possibility of a constitutional reform or not, and today in the morning we have already talked about. If we have to consider also a sort of great expectations that all European citizens have from European Union, in some period even too much, and this is maybe linked to that, to your discourse about success stories, failure stories, so maybe too many expectations. So Anya said, if only 30% of citizens go and vote to the Italian election, no one will give up with Italy. And now we are thinking if we have to give up with Europe, according to the number of voters. So I think we have to, this is just a general comment about the great expectations that Europeans have built around Europe, overcharging in some way Europe in comparison with national governments. And another, I have a question for Andrew Burgess. You mentioned a certain number of changes of the name of ALDE during the years.
Yeah.
I think since we have a similar story with a party in Italy, I think that these changes of name could correspond to the change of the components, of course, so the different, since ALDE is an alliance, so a different, but I'm guessing if this could correspond also to a change of vision, or not only of political identity, that is a bit too large, but a change of political and economic vision, and how this could be considered in recent Macron participation to the alliance.
Any more questions? Okay, then I'll take the privilege of the chair to add the last few questions. Actually, the first one will be a little more specific on the same point as Daniela last made. What are you going to do about En Marche after the election? Because that's what we're being told. We are being told that it will happen after the election. We want to know. Okay. In a way related to this, the Euro elections, which at this point will take place in Britain, indicate that there may be two success stories, the Brexit Party on one hand, and the Liberal Democrats. So how do you see this prospect as having an impact on what's going to happen to Brexit? Chris Lord, who's one of the early scholars who studied the European Parliament in Britain, thinks that what happens in the Euro elections may have an impact. I don't know, frankly, but you know, I would like to hear what you have to think about that. Continuing on, Monica Fassone, I'm intrigued as a citizen by the difficulty sometimes we have in evaluating the environmental impact of certain supposedly environmentally friendly solutions. One of the things that was in your presentation, more trains, less planes, okay? But high-speed trains are very impactful. One of the biggest debates in Italy is what to do with alta velocità, okay? And high-speed trains are the only alternative to planes. I see that, I went to Switzerland recently, and what they've done with the high-speed lines is something that in Italy will not be accepted by many. And I could go on with many examples of how things that would be considered environment friendly are considered actually impactful by even by environmentalists and not only by critics. And so I would like to know, how as citizens, who should we listen to? Then, when I first became aware of the existence of the Greens in the 60s, was that they were post-materialist. Environment was something separate from the economy. Now, the Greens try to reconcile both. Again, this is a very difficult exercise. Do you see this as something problematic, or do you have ready solutions? And finally, you talk about change, but I think at least about the things I was saying, I'm right about the fact that to produce change through the European Parliament, you have to form majorities. So you're talking about a different majority. Can you tell us what kind of majority you envisage for the kind of change you want? Since the sovereignists don't want to tell us, I agree that there should be change. And actually, in the beginning, I was timidly hinting at the fact that maybe it's the Greens that could bring this change about. So please tell us what it is. Finally, this is a specific question to Anya. Again, it has to do with Brexit. Okay, well, I think non-Brexit would advantage the Socialist Party in Europe the most, because it is, you would get a fairly sizable delegation, not as big as maybe in the past, and the European People's Party wouldn't get any. So how do you feel about this? Is there anything that has been discussed? No, what I'm saying, are there alternative views of what may happen? Is the PES going to try and influence the debate in Britain or what? Okay, thank you. Now, we have 15 minutes, so 5 minutes each. As a rule, we start from the last speaker.
Of course. How do we feel about having a larger group than before? Fantastic.
No, I ask you, what are you going to do? Are you going to do something to make it happen?
Well, I think, because Andrew and me had actually spent some time discussing the question of Brexit, most evidently. It's his favorite question when he comes everywhere, anywhere, actually, for any debate these days. I think, one thing is, of course, the possible net gain, which could be a good news, at least temporary. I mean, the future is very much unknown in terms of Brexit debate. But I think what Brexit is showing us is a couple of trends that nevertheless remain very important signals for the rest of the European Union. Number one, it's the question of, democracy. Britain is one of the oldest and most established democracy we would claim. And now we seem to be facing, and the last elections, they already have been mentioned, but also this whole return to the parliament, this whole poking debate, is basically a situation in which probably all the arguments have already been laid down. The members of House of Commons not always go exactly in the same way as their constituencies would have, because they go with the partisan line. And that's one of the examples where we see a difficulty on the level of representative democracy. And I think, that's something for all of us to think about around the edge of relevant question being the European Union. The second thing is the issue of generally why the Brexit vote happened in the way it happened. Of course, I mean, all of us have been discussing very specific, programmatic proposals for the European elections. But the problem with Europe is that, you have this sort of, oh, let's discuss the facts and so on. But in the end of the day, every campaign is the campaign of appearances much more than the campaign of the facts, because it appears very frequently to people's emotions, to what actually, frustrated them or make them happy in the last moment before. And I think what's interesting about the referendum in the UK, and I don't want to go into entire socioeconomic breakdown of how the vote went and so on, because we would discuss, much longer. But I think what is interesting is this question of affinity, where people feel that they belong to the European community, but they not always feel that they are European citizens. And this sort of divergence, which is specifically important in the context of the European elections, is something that all of our parties sort of need to address. So last thing, possibly, and that relates to the question of I think it was Angela, who was talking about the national boundaries and so on. I mean, Brexit was one of the typical examples when the discussion was about Europe, but Europe, even though everybody in Europe has had an opinion about Brexit and how people in Britain should vote, the debate in Britain was very much British, and you know, all the transnational parties did its best actually not to involve in this debate, because we were all saying, you know, those are our friends, and friends, you know, you allow them to decide by themselves because it's a sovereign sovereign fate of the nations, whilst by Brexit, actually, all the European citizens will effectively be affected and already are, even mentally. So that's one of, you know, very important question that we have to see about the multilateral responsibility. The question of Francesco, I think it was a very interesting question about, you know, the end to the crisis of the traditional parties and not. I think, you know, one thing is, which I would say in the broader context, we have a tendency or inclination to put anti-systemic and anti-establishment in the same basket, and they are not the same things. And I mean, certain hypes that we see in the current elections, for example, in Spain. I mean, if you look at Pedro Sanchez, I have 1 minute, and I started just about Pedro Sanchez, so terrible. he managed to accumulate
the one was 5 minutes, so.
I haven't seen that one. I attend blind eye. He managed to accumulate the anti-establishment sentiment within the side of the party, because if you want, the entire party elite was against him, but they didn't make socialists in Spain anti-systemic at all. So I think, you know, when we are looking at the future of the traditional parties or transnational parties, I mean, this question of anti-systemic versus anti-establishment is an important distinction to make. Last but not least, I want to just very quickly address this issue of the national elections, transnational list. I think it's a pity that transnational list didn't pass through. I mean, all of us sitting by this table would have supported that. Of course, you know, we would have to see how it would develop. But I would sort of disagree with the fact that the European Union does not really enter the national debate. I think it does, but the problematic thing is what Daniela has addressed already, is this question of expectation and the very 30 seconds comment on Poland. When the Committee to Defend Democracy was established 3 years ago, people, and there was really a river of people marching through the cities of Poland, they had two flags, Polish and the European one. And it was clearly the expectation for the European Union to deliver. Now, from the side of the European Union, and you know, Frans Timmermans is today our candidate and, you know, the fighter in terms of regime in Poland. The problem is that today people feel that European Union either mingled too much, those are the anti-Europeans, or hasn't delivered enough by defending democracy, you know, regardless of the fact that we should be defending democracy in our own country. So in that sense, this sort of big expectations are there. But I think it is a political responsibility to manage between Europe that should have been a dream, 15 years ago it was for my country, and Europe that is, you know, an agreement, and I have to write END, which is the end of my story.
Can I make a point of order?
That's so bad.
No, because I really think it's a bit frustrating, because you let us come here, and you ask us very interesting questions. It's very difficult to finish it in 3 minutes. So, I don't know, is it really 4:30? We really have to finish, because we were saying 4:45.
I am told that
the
car is leaving at
16:40. Okay, fine.
That's what I'm told. So.
Okay. So I was told to be here till 5. So. Okay.
So but anyway, it's time for you to start.
No, because I don't want to go beyond, but it's really very interesting questions, and since you had us coming all the way here, it would be nice to be able to answer in a proper way.
Well, I would love to hear it.
Anyway, so, not only. So, will Salvini manage to make a center-right in Europe? I think that this will very much depend from what will happen in the elections, as always. And if the, first of all, what will happen in Italy, whether or not we will be able to mobilize the vote to go beyond the 50% I was telling you about, and to be able to create a momentum that is not too depressing, let's say, for those like, for example, my own list, that is said not to reach 4%, and therefore to generate a frustration of people, well, you know, I will not go to vote because these people will not reach the threshold, or I will vote for something that I really don't like very much because I want them to. So I really think that we need, and in other countries there will be other dynamics, but I really think that a lot of Salvini's success will be played here in Italy, and it could be that during the European elections, if we manage in the next 3 weeks to develop a certain positive dynamic, his victory will be less than what he thought, and this will, of course, affect what will happen in the rest of the European Parliament. Of course, it also will depend from what will happen at the level of the Popular Party, because the Popular Party must reject the idea of having a majority with the extreme right. But it all depends, of course, on the votes. And so it is very difficult to say it before, but we have to be very clear before the elections of what we don't want to do, and unfortunately the EPP is not clear. So yeah, whether we like it or not, that's a reality, and this is also something that we'll have to make part of a competition, even if we're all very fair and nice. But you know, it's an issue that is quite important. I actually didn't understand your question, your proposal. I don't see the advantage of having 5 elections. It's already very complicated to have 1 election, so I would actually stick it a little bit like this, otherwise our voters would be even more confused. So I would like to say something, also comment to what Professor said earlier. I think that I was not trying to underestimate the importance of the victory of Vox and the others. But keep in mind something that for me was very striking. When you ask people what they really want, you unfortunately are very, or you evaluate, not the people, we, when we study or evaluate, are very much influenced by what media tell us. So when the Gilets Jaunes had the first demonstration in Paris, there were many more people demonstrating on climate than Gilets Jaunes. Mm-hmm. At the end of all this blah blah of Gilets Jaunes, there were 20,000 people in the whole bloody country. So, I mean, I really think that there is such a manipulation and an overestimation of what the real question of people are, that, for example, today the issue that came out a few days ago, that about 70 or 80% of the people consider climate change or issues related to that very important, are completely misrepresented in the debate, and not only in Italy, which, you know, yesterday there was this mega report on biodiversity which came out, and in our news it was number 55 in the news. So this has an impact. We are not in a situation of neutrality in which, you know, people just feel and think what is really important. There is a problem of our democracy is in representing what is really important, and our own work as parties should go in the direction of competing on really what's important. Very briefly on the other points, I think Professor Bardet will have to have another session for the questions you asked, but I try to be very, 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 very short concerning the points you touched. First of all, I actually believe that the problem of Brexit today is that the major liability are the mainstream parties, sorry for this, but also Labour. If Labour would have been clear, yes, we want to stay in the EU, we would have not been in the situation in which we are today. And one of the reasons why today Labour and Conservatives both lost, and Liberals and Greens made an extraordinary, at least also Greens are relatively small party, but went up, is because they are clear, we want to remain, punto. And that's the reason why Farage is very much up in the... So I wish that in the next 3 weeks the Labour will make up its mind of what they want, because Brexit or non-Brexit will most likely depend on them. Really, of course, Liberals are very important, and we're all very important, but I think that if they don't make up their mind, we are in a mess. And unfortunately, today, it was not the situation a few months ago, but today, Brexit is being contagious as an illness also for the rest of the EU. The more the UK doesn't decide, the most the EU will suffer from this bubble wishy-washy situation. Trains, it's very simple. High-speed trains are not the answer for everywhere and in all places. You're referring actually not to a high-speed train, but to the tunnel of Valsusa, which is not even a high-speed train. I will not go into the details, but it is very important that you, the point that we try to make is to ensure a certain change in the modes of movement, let's say, that goes more in the direction of trains and of cars and planes. Of course, I came here by plane. You know, I'm not like Greta, who can go around everywhere, and I have a problem with that, an internal problem, because I know that this is highly contradictory. You know, but on the other hand, I want to give a lot of space for research in aviation. I want to tax, and I want to do all sorts of things we discussed earlier. But there is not only one clear-cut solution. But let's say that if you invest on train, local, regional, high-speed where needed. In France, you have a lot of high-speed trains because you have Paris, Lyon, nothing. In Italy, you don't have Paris, Lyon, nothing. You have a lot of very, very small cities, and this imposes you, and this is a basic of a green and ecologic, of a green and ecologic approach, that you have to check that your recipes can be applied in the place you want to apply to. Yes, we want to reconcile environment and economy, and I tell you what, even in this country, the companies and the industries, we are today more able to hire people and to innovate, are those who bet on the fact that there are little resources and that there is climate change. The problem is what you do with those workers, which today are not yet in that situation. So you have to invest in what is called the just transition. But this is different than to say, I resist and I do nothing. It's a completely different approach, but I agree with those who believe that we have to make this transition desirable. And in order to make this transition desirable, you have already to change your mind. So it's a cat eating its own tail. Last point, our intention is to be strong in the next election and to go up in our votes. Because if we remain where we are not going to be able to be determined. You know, but in the moment in which we are more important, let's say, we are able to determine a majority, we will be there with Weber, without Weber, etc., but on the basis of what I was saying before, of certain contents. And I believe that it will be very interesting and important. We are not saying from the outside, no. That's for sure.
Thank you very much. Andrew.
Thank you. I'll try to be quick on the votes. When will we finally have these elections at EU shoots? I arrived here today and I'm going back later tonight from Ireland where I'm campaigning in European elections, and every conversation I'm having on the doorstep is not on Europe, it's on the local issue, it's on the hospital that's closed, it's on the blitz, and we are changing that conversation. We are having an active conversation on the doorstep. This is why Europe matters to you, and it's making a huge difference. A lot, I think, has to go in with communications. I mean, it's a bit of a cliche. If it goes well, the national party, the national state takes credits. If it goes bad, they blame Brussels. You know, we need to get out of this mentality of doing it. And I know for definite they do it in the Netherlands and Denmark and Scandinavia, and probably in others as well. But they have debates in their national parliament the week before and the week after a European summit, where they discuss the issues, mandate the Prime Minister to take a position on behalf of the country, and then they come back and debate it afterwards. So you immediately have all of those people in that country engaged before a summit and after the summit, and you've got some more accountability. So I'd like to see that. And yeah, I'd love to see transnational lists. I'd love to see the European demos coming through. And until we get there, sadly, we're going to be having 27, 28 national elections to a European Parliament. Look, it brings me on to En Marche, the question that I get almost.
$1 million question.
Exactly.
I don't have that kind of
This is symptomatic to what we... I mean, there was another question about how a party's changing. I think this is a prime example of how they are. We are seeing movements get elected, and then the movement is becoming a political party.
Yeah.
You're not seeing a political party forming and then getting elected. I mean, there are lots of other scenarios. Take Slovenia. A movement pops up 3 weeks later, there's an election, they're the Prime Minister, and then they turn themselves into a political party. So, and En Marche is very symptomatic of this. I mean, his whole raison d'etre was to shake up politics. Therefore, we, right from the start, knew that they wouldn't join something straight away, because how can they shake up something by immediately joining something already? It's a counterproductive thing. I mentioned in my presentation that the group has changed name many times. Yeah, we changed name when the Italians joined us because liberal was a bad word.
Yeah.
We put reform in when the French joined.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so yeah, it wouldn't shock me if we changed the group name in the European Parliament if Macron joins. I highly doubt it will be En Marche, Alde, or Renaissance. I mean, you can't really connect to the general.
Alde, En Marche.
Yeah,
you can.
A party name of the people, isn't it? Renaissance. It screams elite from the start. He won't do anything until after the European elections, because that's when his power is the most. He still thinks he's the messiah that's going to come in with 40, 50 MEPs and shift the balances around. On current polling, he's only going to bring in 20. 20 is a lot less than 40. You know, if he comes in with 40, then we're going to see some real changes. If it's 20, they won't be the biggest delegation in ALDE. But the co-founder of En Marche was present at our Congress when we adopted our manifesto. She performed a speech where she declared that they have common platforms,
mm-hmm.
We will run an electoral alliance together, and to use her words, those who campaign together will sit together.
Yeah.
And one bit that we always bring up with journalists, particularly in the Brussels bubble, is there are two En Marche MEPs already sitting in the European Parliament. Both of them sit in the ALDE group.
Yeah.
And both of them are candidates again for re-election. So it's not a huge shock that they're in discussion with us, or this, but there's also a national element to why he's looking at his different options and playing this game. And Greens, he will try to bring together a broad progressive alliance, and given the priorities that all three of us have picked up today, there's quite a few similarities in there already. And then finally, my favourite topic of all, Brexit. Now, last week we had local elections in the UK. These were really interesting because they were only in England. So there were no local elections in Wales and Scotland. So Brexit, this was the barometer for Brexit, if you want to put it in that way. And you saw a new party that broke from Labour. So when Labour couldn't make up its mind, half of the new party, they created a new one called Change UK. Change UK did not stand in the local elections. And Nigel Farage's new party, the Brexit Party, also did not stand. So you had the Conservative Party with four different messages on Europe, Labour with four different messages on Europe, the Greens with one message on Europe, Lib Dems with one message, look who won. The Lib Dems recorded their biggest ever electoral result. We held 700 seats, we gained 700 seats, we only lost 7 across the entire country that we contested. It was enormous for our party, absolutely enormous. And we also saw this with our sister party in Northern Ireland, Alliance. It did its best ever election result on these grounds. They had a clear message, they stuck with it. The European elections are a completely different kettle of fish because they are on a different electoral system. It's not first past the post. It's proportional representation. We also have a really strange division of constituencies, which means the constituency is so large that it's quite amazing, really. Yeah, exactly. And we also, in these elections, will have Change UK, the Greens, and the Lib Dems all splitting the Remain vote. We will have the Conservative Party and Labour, that nobody knows where those votes are going to go. And then you'll have Nigel Farage's party, who he just calls it Brexit because he's a genius. I mean, I predicted this a long time ago. I mean, he has already said, we are not forming a party structure, we are not issuing a manifesto, we're not doing any campaign events. Their message on their posters, when they get printed, will be, you voted Brexit 3 years ago, vote Brexit again.
Yeah.
That will be their message.
Yeah. Yeah.
Brexit is on the ballot paper, vote for us. So the Brexit Party will win these European elections. That is not in doubt. Over half of our MEPs will come back as the Brexit Party, because the Remain vote will split all the different ways, and with the system, it doesn't work too nicely, so I'm afraid there's going to be a lot more turmoil and things, and we've not left, and I'm sorry, but I don't think we're going to be leaving anytime soon.
Yeah, I
agree. Yeah, just come with a very short remark, is that from what I've seen is that Labour lost 80 seats, and Sèvres has lost 1,300.
Yeah.
So it's a little bit of a different type of loss.
Yeah, I mean, the context again is these elections were held in 2015, which were the same day as the general election. And that was the general election when the Liberal Democrats were kicked out of coalition government with the Conservatives. So all of those
so
seats
the
Conservatives gained were always going to come back.
Exactly.
But they came back much more than anybody else.
That's
good. Thank you very much. And thank you again, the organizers and participants in this last round table. Thank you.
Sorry.